Red Eye is 3 hours of alternative politics and culture, broadcast live from 9 until noon every Saturday morning on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver, Canada. Here is Peter Royce.
For anyone worn down by years of Bushism, the impossible will take a little while is a bracing double cappuccino. That's what Barbara Ehrenreich had to say about a new book by Paul Loeb. Subtitled A Citizen's Guide to Hope in a Time of Fear, the book draws together the voices of activists, artists and thinkers. Some of the most inspiring figures in the fight for social justice join with unknown writers to reflect on what it takes to sustain hope. Paul Loeb writes and lectures widely and is an associate scholar at Seattle's Center for Ethical Leadership. Good morning, Paul.
I'm very glad to be here.
So now you begin the book in your introduction with Desmond Tutu, and you end the book with his essay, No Future Without Forgiveness. Why is Tutu for you an important symbol of hope?
Well, because if I look at Tutu's life, I mean, The Impossible Will Take a Little While is about how to persist in hard times, and, you know, unfortunately in this global world, the hard times spill across the border so that, you know, the actions of a madman in Washington, D.C., alas, affect, you know, Canada, Iraq, you know, Afghanistan, Chile, you know, the whole world. And so it's a, you know, it's a challenge we're all going to have to deal with, even though, unfortunately, my particular countrymen, or some of them, half of them, elected this destructive person. And so the question is how do you keep on in the face of really difficult situations? And to me, Tutu is a model, because if you think of his life, I mean, he's up against immense difficulties. I mean, under that apartheid regime, friends and colleagues tortured, murdered, imprisoned for decades. I mean, this is hard stuff to live with, even as a bishop and an archbishop later and a Nobel Peace Prize winner, facing daily humiliation in South Africa as a black man. When the democracy finally comes, putting together that Truth and Reconciliation Commission to try and bring out the hardest, just most awful stories of brutality so that the society can really come to grips with them and move on from that, challenging Bush's war in Iraq, going to Rwanda to try and bring some healing there. And you look at the sum total of that, and you would think this would be enough to tax anyone's spirit and leave anybody bleak and lead anyone just, you know, despairing, brittle, depressed. And yet, of course, if you've ever had the opportunity to see or hear Tutu talk, it's amazing, because he's the most delightful, engaged person you could ever imagine. And he's a model for dealing with the hardest, most difficult issues and coming out with a kind of grace of spirit. And so I use this example from Los Angeles, where it was a benefit for our South African project, and he was speaking at it. And he's been battling, on top of everything else, he's been battling prostate cancer. So he lay down for a nap beforehand, was feeling kind of low physically, gave his talk, some other people spoke. And then a band starts playing from East Los Angeles, and people start dancing. I look over, there is Desmond Tutu right out in the middle of the dance floor, just dancing away and enjoying every moment of it. And I'm thinking, this is interesting. I've never seen a Nobel Peace Prize winner dance before, much less an archbishop. And the lesson, I think, is that this is somebody who absolutely savors life, every moment of it. And so that's intertwined with his passion for justice. And in fact, you almost can't, not only is it intertwined, I'd say it's almost inseparable. And so that's why, to me, he's such an appropriate figure, because it's that generosity of spirit. It's not like he ducks hard questions. I mean, at one point in The Impossible Will Take a Little While, there's a scene, somebody else, Jim Wallace, the wonderful activist minister from Sojourners, is writing it, where There's a gathering at a South African church in the middle of apartheid, and the cops are, it's basically a freedom rally, and so the cops are lining the walls of the church, beating on their hands with their nightsticks, ready to break everything up. And Tutu is speaking, and at one point he says to them, you are on the wrong, to the cops very specifically, you are on the wrong side of history. But then he switches, and he says, but you're very welcome to come onto the right side, and sort of smiles at them and invites them in. And I think that's also part of the vision, is it's a vision that doesn't duck hard questions, but it is also very generous-spirited.
The book tells us that we can't necessarily tell in the middle of a struggle how our efforts will affect the outcome of a situation. What are some of the stories that reveal that insight for you?
Well, for example, one of my favorite stories in The Impossible will take a little while is the Václav Havel story. And he's writing about the growth of the democracy movement in Czechoslovakia. And he's writing this in 1986. So he's writing it 3 years before the Berlin Wall falls, 3 years before Czechoslovakia has its Velvet Revolution. He's writing it under a dictatorship. And he starts tracing the roots of the democracy movement actually to a rock band, the Plastic People of the Universe, that was influenced by American musicians like Frank Zappa and the Velvet Underground. And the authorities didn't like them and said they were morbid and not socially constructive, which I thought was a great bureaucratic phrase. So they started breaking up their concerts and pulling their musicians' union cards and starting to jail them. And at a certain point, Havel is a little older and more respectable, forms a defense committee. And that evolves into Charter 77. That's the pivotal democracy group that would end up, in fact, bringing the regime down, a dozen or so years later. And just the idea that you would start out defending the rights of a rock band and end up bringing down a dictatorship that everyone thinks was completely entrenched, that's very powerful. At another moment in the same struggle, they're circulating a petition to free some political prisoners, and it's interesting because Havel himself is constantly in and out of jail, and they're getting mocked and condescended to, and the novelist Milan Kundera, very well-known, probably the best-known novel writer in Czechoslovakia, refuses to sign the petition and says they're just being indulgent and exhibitionistic and won't do any good. And Havel, looking back about 7 years later, says, we actually did not free any political prisoners. So on some level, the critics were right that we failed. We tried, and sometimes you don't win. He said, on the other hand, when those people got out of jail, they said it was our efforts that allowed them to keep going. And that meant everything to them. And so they could continue to challenge the regime. And not only that, everybody who came in to sign the petitions, they aren't going away either. And they're now challenging the regime in 100 different ways, preaching different sermons, playing different music, putting on different plays, having different conversations, teaching differently. And what it reminded me is that in any social change effort, we're really doing two things. We're trying to win a particular battle, win an election, succeed in an environmental fight or labor fight, stop a war, whatever it is. We're also doing something larger, which is we're trying to build the base of people who work for justice. And if we can succeed in doing that, sometimes we win even though we fail in our immediate short-term objectives. And I think that's very hopeful, ultimately, to recognize that.
Now, a couple of essays in the book talk about music as an important form of sustenance for people in their struggles. Can you tell me something of those?
Yeah, which is a wonderful, a late writer named Rosemary Harding, who just talked about the songs of the Civil Rights Freedom Movement and the way that they almost literally created a physical space of protection around the people singing them. And I remember, I can't remember if it was her story or one that I had just heard and wrote about in the book, but there was a point where there was a gathering at the black church, and the Klan was surrounding it, and people could have gotten killed, and they just started singing, and these sounds just booming out into the night, and these Klansmen melted away, and so it was a sense of the spirit lifting. It's the same kind of thing in that wonderful Cha 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 story from Zambia that you read a short while earlier, where when human imagination and courage can join, there's no telling what can happen. Well, it's kind of like the wonderful Seamus Heaney poem, the Irish Nobel Prize winner, that I use it. I have a poem frame. I have 9 sections in The Impossible. Take a little while, and a poem frames each one. And the lines of the poem, which I love, is history says don't hope on this side of the grave, but then once in a lifetime the longed for tidal wave of justice can rise up and hope and history rhyme. And I love that because it's this sense that says you don't always see it, but sometimes it rises up, and that's when it all hope and history really does rhyme and justice prevails, or at least moves forward.
So now, in addition to music, where else have social activists looked for the strength to keep going when times get tough?
Well, I think there's a combination of things. I mean, so one is history, these unexpected turnings of history, like in the case of Václav Havel. Howard Zinn has a great essay called The Optimism of Uncertainty, where he just looks at time and time again how you manage to, because of human courage, history changes in unexpected ways. So that's part of it. Community is critical. There's an amazing essay. There's one of the major civil rights groups, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. One of the leaders is now a U.S. congressman from Georgia, very progressive, describes this moment when that kept him going through the hardest times. When he was a child and there was this huge storm, he was at his aunt's ramshackle, really calling it a house is a, you know, too much. It was really a shack. And it was starting to blow off the foundation. They would have been killed. And his aunt had the little children move from one corner to the other as each began to blow off to hold it down with their frail bodies, the weight of it. And it was a metaphor for him of how community, even in vulnerability, can bring strength that he said kept him going through jail, through beatings, through just the hardest times. And so I think community is part of it. Imagination, again, as in the cha-cha-cha, or as in just the wonderful Susan Griffin essay where she talks about, you know, and he was a situated scene in at Auschwitz where they were being taken away to the Birkenau to be killed, and there was a surrealist poet named Robert Desnoy who started very energetically reading people's palms and saying they were going to have a very long life and many children, and you know, everyone's thinking, I'm going to die in 20 minutes. I mean, they all knew what they were being brought over for in this truck, but then suddenly the mood starts to change in this sort of sense, well, maybe it's not inevitable. And the guards get very uneasy. They end up taking the truck and turning it around back to Auschwitz. And although Desnos does die in the camps, some of the people actually survived. And it's just this, you know, it's not to say you can wish your way out of Auschwitz or wish your way, you know, the Iraq War wouldn't happen or you know, wish your way out of a disastrous election. But it's to say that imagination always can bring us new possibilities and sometimes we can act on them. That's tremendously important, I think. You know, and again, obviously savoring the grace of the world, as Tutu does, that's critical as well. I've got in one of my earlier books, Soul of a Citizen, I write about a 101-year-old friend of mine who was born in Victoria, lived most of her life in Seattle. And she would just say, well, you go hiking, you go kayaking, and then she gets this mischievous smile, and she says, then you get ready to come back ready to take on Exxon. And it's a sense of just delight in the world coupled with a fierce kind of fire of resistance. And then, of course, part of that resistance spirit is the Mary Wynne Ashford essay suggests it is about being true to yourself.
Now, many of the politically engaged writers draw on a religious or spiritual dimension, while others are steadfastly secular. Was there a tension for you in bringing these two sets together, or bringing together these approaches even?
Well, I think there wasn't a tension for me. There may be a tension for some of the readers, but I know there are because, I mean, this is true of The Impossible. It'll take a little while. It was true with my last book, Soul of a Citizen. I was just at Syracuse, New York, and there was a young woman in the class who just got very, very upset that there were some people who were acting from religious faith in the book. And I said, well, you know, if the metaphors, and of course, you know, from the flip side, more conservative religious folks is just like, well, how can these people who don't have a sense of God, how can they dare, you know, call themselves acting for justice? And I think, to me, I mean, I've been around citizen movements long enough, about 30 years, to recognize that these are metaphors for explaining our connection with that which is larger than ourselves. And so some people may call it God, and some people may just look out on Puget Sound and just look at this, you know, amazing landscape that we have. I mean, I'm south of the border, but we share the same mountains and the same water, and you know, just be stunned and healed by it. And I think either way, we're talking about a similar sense of larger connection. And when people use it for justice, that's a powerful force. And so I was very deliberate in the mix, and there indeed are people who are coming from a very strong, you know, Christian or Jewish, a couple Buddhists, one Islamic perspective, and people who are very secular. And to me, what brings them together is that they're all acting for justice.
One of the essays in the book was called The Great Work in the Small Work. Did you find that idea recurring in the contributions you chose?
Well, I think I did, because it was from, I think she was quoting some other essay herself. It was a wonderful, and one of the things that happened is that I put The Impossible Take a Little While together, first going to the people that I most admired who had sustained me, Alice Walker, Mandela, Havel, Marion Wright Edelman, Wendell Berry, just, you know, sort of international, Neruda, and, you know, and then I put out a call. I have a 12,000-name email list, and people actually, if they go to the website for the book, which is theimpossible.org, they can sign up on it. And I just put out this general call for, you know, are there essays that inspire you? And, of course, some people suggested the same essay, same people, because they were the people who inspire all of us. But at the same time, there were some very unknown writers, and one of the, you mentioned the essay, The Small Work and the Great Work. It was a Unitarian minister in Minneapolis, and somebody in her congregation just emailed me and said, I have this amazing, this minister gives these astoundingly eloquent sermons, and they're up on her website, and you might want to check them out. And I looked at them, and I thought, whoa, this is just this wonderful gift of vision. And I stitched a few of them together, and then said, you know, could we use something of this? And she said, of course. And so part of what I liked is that this book came about through a community, and part of the points that, as you're saying, is that it's the humble actions that often lead up to the larger ones. I have an essay myself about Rosa Parks, and we all think of that moment on the bus where Rosa Parks refuses to move. Most people don't know that she was an activist with the NAACP for a dozen years. Before that, she was a secretary of the local in Montgomery. She went to training sessions at her Highlander Center, which is a labor and civil rights center in Tennessee. And basically, this was an action that wasn't isolated. It didn't come out of a whim. It was a very conscious action, building on a community, and preceded by a great deal of humble actions before that. And you didn't see the network news cameras zeroing in and saying Rosa Parks is making history by taking minutes at an NAACP meeting, but that was also part of the process and also part of her journey. So I think the notion of the combination of, you know, the dramatic, the global stage, and the more humble and unknown, I think that's part of what makes change.
Now, you've included the writing, as you've mentioned, of quite a few political prisoners. We've heard from a few, like the Uruguayan activist Nelson Mandela, Vaclav Havel. What do we have to learn from them?
Well, it's interesting because they're people in, I guess, extreme situations might be the way to describe it. And I look at that and I think, if they can find a way to act in an extreme situation, so can I in a situation that may be difficult, but certainly is in no way comparable. So you look at Mandela. I mean, he goes to that island prison and he's told, Mandela, you'll never leave Robben Island alive. You know, first few years you might think it's going to change, and then 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, it becomes your life. And so what do? You find ways to resist. You're denied newspapers, and you see a guard drop their sandwich wrapper, which is a newspaper, in a trash can. You smuggle it, and on a tiny script, copy, you know, the story that might inspire your fellow prisoners. Or there's a guard who's being particularly abusive, and you're both firm, but you also reach out as a human being. And he ends up, after a series of conversations where they actually explain why the ANC has a multiracial position, and he says, well, it makes more bloody sense than nationalists. You somehow manage to touch this guard, so you're always finding ways to act. And I think the lesson to me is, well, I may not be ever, I mean, I certainly hope I'm never in a situation like that, but I can find ways to act in my situation, inspired by those in the most difficult one. I mean, there's a prisoner who's not anybody anyone's particularly heard of in Louisiana, who was at some point, he was not a political prisoner, he killed somebody and went in jail as a young man and changed and wrote on this amazing prison newspaper. And at one point, they were offering pardons, they were selling pardons, it was a corrupt pardon board. And he had the chance to buy his way out, and said he blew the whistle on it, and the pardons board head is now in jail. But this man angered enough of the powers that be that he's still in jail as well. And boy, you know, I was thinking, boy, what a sacrifice to make there. Could I imagine doing something like that? And I think the answer is, well, I don't know, but I am going to do what I can. And that's a key lesson of The Impossible. It'll take a little while, is that there are always things that we can do and always ways to act.
So now you've created quite a compendium here. How do you hope that people will actually use the book?
Well, they're using it in a number of ways. I mean, I know on the state side, since the election, I've just gotten hundreds of emails saying, this is the only thing keeping me from jumping off a bridge. It, you know, the effect's a little bit more diffuse across the border. At least you had a government that didn't support the Iraq War for all of its, you know, mixed nature. So I think what I hope is that people will use it to keep going. And at that point that things get hard, and they always do, they'll use it to say, look, we know it's hard, but it's been hard for other people as well, and this is how we can continue. I mean, that's what I really wrote it for, is this, this sense of often global despair that I was just hitting, with people feeling that their efforts didn't matter, and yet recognizing that only through those difficult efforts can things change. And, you know, it's, I mean, you look at, you know, Wangari Maathai over in, was it Kenya, I guess it is, who just won the Nobel Peace Prize. I mean, you know, she was beaten, jailed, I mean, up against all sorts of things, you know, and yet persisting. And I remember the first time years ago that some friends of mine who knew her were talking about this amazing work that this woman did. And, you know, you have to persist, even if it's not in the spotlight. You have to persist, even if you don't necessarily succeed at first. And so my sense is, I mean, a lot of people are already starting to read the book in reading groups. Which is very nice. I mean, you know, just in community groups, political groups, church groups, to keep them going for justice. I think it's a good. I actually have some questions up on the website, theimpossible.org, and I think it's a good book to keep people going. You know, not just in isolation, but to actually be read and discussed together. And also, I think it's I don't know. I remember one of the there was a national sort of alternative radio network in the States called Pacifica, and one of their news anchors said, well, she was just reading an essay or a poem every morning just to keep her going, and kind of rationing it out so that she had something every day that just had a sense of hope. And my sense is that's so important because we need that in these difficult times.
Well, thanks very much, Paul. This is, I really appreciate it. We may actually just take that idea up here. Thanks very much for joining me this morning.
Oh, well, my pleasure, anytime.
I've been speaking with Paul Loeb. The Impossible Will Take a Little While is published by Basic Books. And as he was saying, you can check it out at www.theimpossible.org and, of course, ask for it at progressive bookstores.
You've been listening to a program produced by Red Eye, an alternative media collective which broadcasts every Saturday morning from 9 until noon on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. In Vancouver, Canada.